Well, it's such a powerful story, I hesitate to even try to embellish it with any additional words, but we have to do that today. You know, if you ask the average person on the street what his or her eschatology is, you'll get a look of confusion, along with some skepticism about your sanity. If you ask the average Christian in the church what his or her eschatology is, you are likely to get a look of embarrassed puzzlement, probably because they don't know what the meaning of the term is. So if you ask, well, what is the final end toward which the world and humanity is heading, you still might get some blank stares, but many Christians would reply with terms like premillennial, and postmillennial, and amillennial, and rapture, or the Great Tribulation, but with very little consensus among them. Now, just take one small subtopic of eschatology, the afterlife, and you will hear a myriad of answers even on this subject. Outside the church, many people have adopted the view called annihilationism, the belief that the soul ceases to exist at death. Another popular belief is reincarnation, which is not restricted to Hinduism. A third belief, increasingly popular, is a merger of the soul with creation, and you'll see this illustrated in the Avatar movies. Various religions offer a variety of beliefs on the subject as well, with variations even among their own faith communities. Beliefs inside the church vary with the same amplitude. Some Christians have adopted the annihilationism position. But most would believe that in the eternal nature of the human soul on some level. The destiny of the soul, however, will elicit a variety of answers, which include heaven, purgatory, and hell, although some Christians are moving away from the belief in an eternal state of damnation. The waters get pretty murky here. But this is not totally surprising, since the Apostle Paul tells us that we see through a glass dimly. Our view of eternity is very limited, with only a small number of passages that describe the afterlife. There are, however, quite a number of passages in both the Old and New Testaments that refer to the resurrection of the body at some point in the future. Surprisingly, the majority of believers talk much more about heaven than they do about the resurrection of the body as God's final goal for human life. In spite of the fact that bodily resurrection is an article of faith in both the Nicene and Apostles' creeds. Instead, what you hear mostly around the funeral parlors is reference to the deceased being in their eternal home, where they are enjoying an eternal rest, socializing with all their relatives and friends who have passed on before them, and playing an infinite number of rounds of golf, or doing whatever else they enjoyed in this earthly life. It is a mystery how such confusion about the afterlife has evolved, given that there are no biblical passages that even imply such conditions during the intermediate state of the soul exist. That time between death and the final resurrection of all the dead. When Jesus arrived at Martha and Mary's home upon the death of their brother, Lazarus, he did not try to comfort them with some mention of heaven or some eternal rest. So let's look a little more carefully at this lengthy passage in John's Gospel. In fact, it may be the longest narrative in all of the Gospels describing any single event outside of the death and resurrection of Jesus himself. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were very close friends and devoted followers of Jesus. They lived in Bethany, a small village only 2 miles from Jerusalem. And when Lazarus falls ill, the sisters send a message to Jesus about the critical condition of their brother, hoping that Jesus would arrive in time to heal him. Jesus was staying with his disciples probably within a day's travel of Bethany. When he receives the message about his friend, he declares that the illness will not end in death, but it will actually result in spotlighting the power of Jesus and bringing glory to both him and his father. And it is important to remember the uniquely close relationship that Jesus has with the Father and his ability to know the will and the purpose of God at any point in time, unlike most of us who would wish we could understand that more readily. Jesus remained where he was for another 2 days before deciding to go to Bethany. The disciples actually pushed back on that decision because traveling in Judea so close to Jerusalem meant a possible encounter with Jewish leaders who wanted to stone him at their last interaction. Jesus indicates that he is not fearful of what will happen because he is confident that he is following the will of God. Of course, Jesus has already told the disciples that he would eventually be crucified, that this was his calling. He also reveals to his disciples that Lazarus has already died, which he could know only because of his relationship with the Father. Now, at first he says he is asleep, a euphemism that was commonly used in Jewish community as it reflected the belief in a final resurrection of the dead. And I'll talk about this a little more later. The reason for his delay in going to Bethany is not that it will result in, the reason for his delay in going to Bethany is that it will result in an unprecedented miracle that will solidify their faith and the faith of many of his followers. Now, the chronology is important here. When Jesus finally arrives in Bethany, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. So assuming a day of travel and the 2 days before leaving for Bethany, we can conclude that Lazarus most likely died when the messenger was on his way from the sisters to inform Jesus of Lazarus's illness. This is important because Jesus postponing his journey to Bethany did not result in Lazarus suffering and Jesus neglecting to heal his dear friend. The postponement had a distinct impact on the magnitude of the miracle that he was about to perform. When Jesus reaches Bethany, he stays outside the village and sends a messenger to inform Martha of his arrival. She leaves the house full of mourners to meet with him privately. Martha's comment, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died," is not a rebuke or a complaint. It is merely a statement of faith. She's already done the math. She knows that her brother died before Jesus probably even received word of his illness. Jesus tells her that her brother will rise again, and Martha confesses a belief in the final resurrection of the dead, as most Jews would have at that time. But Jesus means much more by his statement. Verse 25 is one of the seven I am statements that some commentators believe provide the structure for John's gospel. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Jesus claims that any resurrection must derive from him, from his authority and his power. In this statement, he also alleges that he is the source of all life, that it begins with him and continues with him. This is one of his many claims to deity and needs verification beyond a mere verbal declaration. Of course, Jesus is about to provide that in duplicate. Martha returns to the house and tells Mary that Jesus is outside the village. Mary immediately goes to meet him. Now, the mourners, supposing that Mary and Martha are going to the tomb, they decide to follow them. When Jesus sees Mary's tears and the weeping of the mourners, he is deeply moved both emotionally and spiritually. The Greek for greatly troubled has generated some debate about what caused the aggravation of his soul. Was it death and its assault on God's creation? Or was it the apparent lack of faith of these people? A good case can actually be made for both interpretations, but I don't want to linger here this morning. I will leave that for you to settle for yourself. Jesus asked the sisters to take him to the tomb. There were different kinds of burial sites at this time. Lazarus happened to be buried in a ground-level cave with a large stone rolled in front of the opening to keep out the animals, very much like Jesus himself was buried in. Jesus instructs some men to remove the stone, but Martha protests that the body's decomposition will have produced a very foul odor by this point. Jesus reminds her that she must keep her faith focused on him if she wants to truly see the glory of God. Now, John has carefully recorded the tension that has been building in this entire account, which now reaches its climax when Jesus calls out loudly to his friend, "Lazarus, come out!" Absolute silence surrounds the scene as all eyes are fixed on the tomb opening. Will he or won't he appear? Still wrapped in the linen strips used for burial, and with the grave cloth still covering his face, Lazarus shuffles forward into the light of a second life, not from the womb, but from the tomb. Jesus tells some of the mourners to remove the grave clothes and set him free. And with that, the record of the event ends. We're not privy to the scene of celebration, drenched with wonder and bewilderment as Lazarus is back home with his sisters and his friends who were only minutes before grieving his death. There's no report of Lazarus' experience during the 4 days of his death, although I have no doubt that it was discussed at length. These things are not germane to the purpose of this extraordinary miracle. Jesus has demonstrated his power of healing on numerous occasions, even to the point of raising some people from their deathbeds, but never has he resurrected a body that had been lying in its grave for several days. Now, John reports the fallout of this unprecedented miracle in verse 46 and following. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And so the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council, which was the Jewish ruling body, and they considered Jesus their nemesis, and he was a false prophet. And so when they get together, following an intense discussion of this man's threat to Israel, it says, from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. This was the final straw. The raising of Lazarus figures heavily in the final decision to have Jesus executed. And it's this close link to Lazarus' resurrection that implies a foreshadowing of the resurrection of Jesus, the two events being probably only a few weeks apart. The disciples have already demonstrated complete cluelessness when Jesus tried to instruct them regarding his coming death and resurrection. And so Jesus intended that this miracle would strengthen the faith of his close followers so that they would be better prepared for his own resurrection. Lazarus' resurrection prefigures another resurrection that I would like to spend more of our time to this morning. The final bodily resurrection of the dead. Now, I don't presume to know what any of you think about the afterlife or eschatology. Well, I might know what my wife thinks. Although, as any honest husband would say, do you ever really know what your wife is thinking? I believe that the way we think about our future has a profound impact on how we live our lives in the present. As I alluded to in the introduction, most Christians have adopted a belief that the disembodied soul of a believer goes into heaven to dwell there in eternal peace and happiness. I hate to say it, but this really is not a biblical teaching. The biblical story begins with Genesis 1 and 2, with the creation of a very good universe in which God places creatures who bear his image and reflect his glory. And the story concludes in Revelation 21 and 22 with the new creation, the fully restored material universe that has been groaning as it waits for the resurrection, which is described in Romans 8, 22 and 23. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. The end of humanity's story is not the destruction of this damaged planet and a disembodied existence in some non-material location. The creation will be redeemed finally when God restores his image-bearing creatures to their original perfect state with the full regalia of material bodies. Now, the majority, as I've mentioned already, the majority of Jews believed in this final resurrection as illustrated by Martha's declaration to Jesus. Ezekiel 37, which we read today, the Valley of Dry Bones, offers a graphic depiction of the hope for a bodily resurrection and restoration to a final perfect state of being. First century Jews understood the resurrection not only as a salvation from centuries of suffering at the hands of oppressors, but also as a vindication when, after faithfully serving the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they would finally be recognized as his chosen people by the world. That's what they were anticipating in the resurrection. Now, all this is not to deny that some intermediate state does exist, where the soul resides as it waits for the final stage of God's redemptive program. Jesus implied so much when he told the thief on the cross, who expressed a fledgling belief in Jesus, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." Paul describes this intermediate existence as being in the conscious presence of Jesus when he told the Philippians, "My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better." So to identify this state with heaven is reasonable, since heaven is the location of God's throne room from where he oversees the entire universe. And I just realized I don't have the rest of my sermon. So I got to fake it. Oh, my gosh, this is so funny. I don't know about this. So where did I go from here? So ultimately, what is happening here is in this story, which I've tried to emphasize over previous sermons I've made, there is this story from beginning to end, creation to new creation, and that God is unfolding this story in throughout the books of the Bible, all of them. And as we look forward to this final resurrection, this is what our hope is. Our hope is not going to heaven temporarily, but some people have elongated this into eternity. I don't know how that's happened, because again, scriptures don't refer to that. But they elongated it into eternity. But it is not, that's not our hope. People are not saved so they can go to heaven. That's what you hear in a lot of evangelism. You don't save people so they can go to heaven. That's not the final result. That's not where we're going. That's only temporary. It's an intermediate state. We may be there for a short time, but we don't even know what it's like, other than the fact we're in the presence of God. And we get pictures in Revelation 21, or throughout the book of Revelation, of God in his throne room. And what a glorious scene that is. And we'll probably see that. I don't know. I don't know. That's the point. We don't know. Why do we make these things up? I don't know. But the end result is to be a final resurrection when we're placed in as it says, where in I forget which passage it is, and where the flesh, the mortal flesh is replaced with the immortal flesh. That which is perishable is now replaced with the imperishable. So our bodies will be transformed and changed and given a whole new structure. Now, the passage that mostly describes the resurrection of the body in the New Testament is 1 Corinthians 15, okay? Apparently, some people had decided to believe, they abandoned the belief that there was going to be a resurrection of the body. They had decided to listen to the culture around them that was arguing reasonably and rationally, because they said, people don't rise from the grave. Have you ever seen anyone rise from the grave? Have you ever seen a dead man walk? Well, obviously some people had seen that. They had seen the resurrection, resurrected Jesus. And they were still alive at this time when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. And so in this book, he lays out an elaborate argument for the reality, for the reasonable reality of the resurrection of the body. And he uses as the foundation the resurrection of Jesus, which, again, many of them had seen. And he even makes the statement, in fact, there are pivotal statements, two pivotal statements in this book, or in this chapter, that are important to understanding the foundation of resurrection, both for Christ and for our bodies, to the Christian faith. He said, if Christ has not been resurrected from the dead, then your faith is futile. In other words, he's saying, if Jesus really didn't rise from the dead, you might as well give up the game and go home, because it's over. Our Christian faith is built on this foundational reality, the resurrection of Jesus. Now he goes on and says, because Jesus has been resurrected from the dead, you too can be expected to be resurrected in the same way, by the same power, at the conclusion of God's program. And he even says, if there's no resurrection of the dead, then let us eat and drink and be merry, because tomorrow you die. In other words, just give yourself over to pleasure. Try to make this life the best you can, because death in the end will win. But Paul is arguing death has not won. Death was conquered at the cross and at the tomb where Jesus rose from the dead. And that therefore we too can anticipate this same resurrection which is promised throughout the scriptures, this same resurrection at the end. Now, why is this important? It's not so that you can pass some theological examination at the end of Lenten season and check the right boxes. It's important because I think what you believe about your future profoundly impacts the way you live life today. If you were planning a Mediterranean cruise or a trip to the Mediterranean countries, you would start planning today. You'd do something about it. You'd start saving money. You'd start booking hotel reservations. You start planning what cities to visit and why those are important to you to want to visit. You'd start buying the clothes appropriate for the weather. You would do a host of things to prepare for that trip. Something in the future affects how you live today, right? It's the same thing. How you view your future and what is in store for you dramatically impacts the way you live today. Somehow, and I don't pretend to understand this, but because there is a resurrection of the dead and because you and I will walk into this new creation, we will bring with us all the things that we have done in this life. They will have bearing in that new creation. Because at the very end of 1 Corinthians 15, with this lengthy argumentation for the resurrection of both Jesus, but particularly for the resurrection of the dead. Paul says, so be immovable and steadfast. For whatever you do for the Lord, whatever you do in the Lord, your work is not in vain. It's not useless. What you do tomorrow, what you do this afternoon, this evening, tomorrow, this week, what you're doing, whenever it's in the Lord and for the Lord, it is not useless. It has meaning. It has bearing, even to the point of the next creation or the new creation. And I had a whole list of things that this could entail. I'll try to enumerate them for you. Serving the poor, showing hospitality, bringing healing to the sick, working for justice, particularly economic inequity, doing things that bring beauty into the world, singing, painting, designing, doing things that improve the world's existence just as it is, building, fixing what is broken, you know, those kinds of things, gardening, baking, all these things that seem so simple and mundane, when done, because we are demonstrating the life and the vibrancy of the creation that God intended for us in the original creation, as we anticipate that life and vibrancy in the new creation, is all part of this, what we do as we bring the reality of the future into the present. Now, this may have echoes to you of a sermon I preached 2 months ago about the kingdom of God. And it's because these themes all are part of the same overarching story arc, this magnificent magnus opus, if you want to think of it in that way, of God's story that he's created from beginning to end. And we're part of that, and we're anticipating that there is a future kingdom, but that kingdom began. There is a new creation, but that new creation has already begun in us. When? At the death and the resurrection of Jesus, when he conquered sin and conquered death. And now we get to live now in the midst of this kingdom, in the midst of this new creation, until we can come into that final chapter, that final demonstration of what this is going to really be. That's what this is all about. And I believe that what we should be doing is living for what is going to be as if it's already been done, because it has already been done. That's the best I got for what I don't have, that last page.
I will close us in prayer. How about that? Lord, thank you that you are the God who breathes life into things that were dead. Please breathe your life into us and these mortal bodies, that we may live by the Spirit now and forever. Amen.